Welcome to Educated Conjecture, an Ipsos podcast that combines what the public thinks with what the experts think. Each week, Ipsos's Mike College and Sean Simpson are joined by an informed guest to discuss a current or emerging issue. Canadians are increasingly concerned about inflation, housing affordability and availability, interest rates, and the economy more generally. In this episode, Mike Moffat, Assistant Professor at Ivy Business School at Western University and Senior Director of Policy at the Smart Prosperity Institute, joins Mike to talk about a wide variety of economic issues that are affecting Canadians, including the impact of COVID, climate change, and more. And now, on to the episode.
Welcome, everybody, to this episode of Educated Conjecture. My colleague, Sean, woke up this morning with laryngitis, so he's not with us, but we have Mike Moffat with us today. How are you, Mike?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Very good. Mike has two primary gigs. Well, he has one primary gig, which is a father of two, and I know that leads you to have a Twitter tagline that says, I used to do other stuff. So I, having four children, I know exactly how that feels, that you used to have other stuff on your plate. But Mike is also a professor at the Ivy School of Business at Western in London, Ontario, and director of research, if I get it correct.
Director of policy. I was going to say, I only correct you because we also have a director of research. Okay. I don't want people to confuse me for Jeff McCarney, who is a fantastic man.
So from where I sit, everything's about research, Mike. So director of policy for the Smart Prosperity Institute. So welcome, Mike. We normally start this off with a couple of highlights of the latest public opinion. So I'm gonna fire out a couple numbers, Mike, and then maybe we can just hop in and discuss your views of where we're headed in the country. We ask a question monthly, have tracked it for years, the most important issues facing Canada. We don't ask personal issues. We ask sort of the broadly, what are the most important issues? Healthcare is still number one, and it's a perennial 1-2. As you probably know, it morphs in and out depending on the time. You know, sometimes it's access and wait times, and sometimes it's quality. And I think now it's a combination of economic issues. Will it be there for me when I need it? And backlog from COVID. But the other issues on the rise are housing, affordability and availability, which I know you've written a little bit about on, the economy overall, which is the catch-all, and interest rates and inflation, which has been on the rise pretty steadily. So both housing and affordability and interest rates and inflation. So you have sort of bookended economic issues, that long-term existential Canadian dream, can I get a home, moving forward, generational gains, and then short-term, how do I get through the week, right, with cost of gas, cost of food, et cetera. So they're sort of being buffered at both ends. And then what's really fallen down the level, even though it hasn't disappeared, the coronavirus is down to fifth and continues to drop. And then the most important existential threat for all of us is probably climate change, and yet it seems to be that issue that's a little further off in the horizon. So it's not so close to us that we can't turn our attention to more urgent concerns, drop down to 6 at 17%. So with that, that's where Canadians are. And obviously it differs by region and differs by demographics. But I just wondered, Mike, given where you sit, what do you think are the most important issues that we're facing right now?
Yeah, my list would look a lot like that. You know, I find when I go to the grocery store, I almost start putting food back once I sort of realize how expensive it is. So the Smart Prosperity Institute is a clean economy think tank. So for us, you know, we would think climate change is number one, but we also have prosperity in our name for a reason, that we recognize that the environment and the economy go together. And we recognize that people's concern about climate change is almost sort of inversely related to how the economy is doing. If the economy is doing really well, then people are quite concerned about climate change because those other sort of economic concerns go out the window. And similarly, when there's all kinds of economic issues, climate change falls down to sixth or worse. So we recognize that we're not going to be able to address the climate emergency if we also don't create the conditions for a strong economy.
Our global CEO describes climate change. He says if COVID was the black swan that suddenly appeared and changed everything, climate change is the gray rhino that's lumbering into view. We know it's coming. In and we know it's going to change things, but it's far enough away that we can, in the short term, divert our attention. And to your point, they're obviously linked. How do we get people to see those linkages better between, because our data shows that people take their eye off of climate change. They don't, they know it's coming, but the sense of urgency declines considerably.
Well, it's a hard story to tell, though I think linking it to other issues that are going on. One of the reasons right now that we have so much inflation in the food market is because we had a drought in Western Canada, drought and fires. So, you know, these issues of inflation and cost of living and climate change are not unrelated. And in fact, they're quite related. But I think, you know, oftentimes us in the environmental NGO space aren't good at telling those stories, aren't good at sort of linking those issues. So I think we need to do a better job, because absolutely that's one of the things that's driving the cost of living, keeping down economic growth. You know, we've had floodings in parts of Canada. We've had a number of natural disasters that you can't necessarily attribute to climate change, but climate change is certainly making those more frequent. So I think the more that we indicate that climate change is not just some 2050 issue that affects faraway places, but is affecting us here and today, and you are paying for the cost of climate change every time you go to the grocery store or every time you pay your insurance bill. There are places in Windsor, Ontario. So I have to make this about Southwestern Ontario because we're both here. You know, there are places in Windsor, large parts of Essex County, where you cannot insure your basement against flooding. And simply because over the last 200 years, we've taken out a lot of the wetlands. But that problem's only going to get worse as the temperatures heat up. You get more evaporation off the Great Lakes. You get more rain. So, you know, tying it to those issues of like, you know, this is why a loaf of bread costs you so much at the grocery store. Or this is why if you're living in Windsor, you can't have your basement insured. It's, you know, these climate change issues and being able to both have policies to adapt to climate change, but also mitigate climate change.
I love the ties to Southwestern Ontario, obviously. So I'll give you two. One, I learned growing up on a soybean farm a long time ago, how international markets change and can affect you. My dad being somewhat gleeful about the rainy season in Brazil, because sunflower oil was not going to be produced and sunflowers were down, so soybeans would be a better market in the fall. And I was at Irio a couple summers ago, and the water line was 4 inches over the sort of 100-year watermark, right? So you do see it, and it does affect people. But at the same time, our governments, most of them have very stated long-term view on climate change, and yet turn around and drop gas taxes and pour cash back into the economy because the price of gas is too high. So we sort of, you can see where the public would have conflicting views.
Yeah, absolutely. I get that as well. And I do think there is a role for government to help people with those cost of living issues in a very direct way. And I would certainly prefer they, you know, give sort of cash transfers to say, you know what, we know gas is really expensive right now. Here's some more money that will not only allow you to buy gas, but also pay for all of those other things that are being made more expensive because of higher oil costs. I think that's fine to do. Where I start to blink a little bit is, you know, where we're trying to sort of ratchet down the price of gas. Instead, we should recognize that, you know, this is what the future looks like if we don't start to take things seriously and really put a big push on electrification or, you know, alternative fuels or that kind of thing. And again, it's where this message of the economy and environment going together, where, you know, if we can have more electric cars, the cost to fill those up or the equivalent is about 10 to 15%, right? You're paying, you know, anywhere from about 5 to 25 cents a liter equivalent to fill up an electric car relative to the $2 a liter that we're now paying. I haven't looked down the street, but it was at least $2 over the weekend.
$2.02 on the weekend when I drove by, yeah. What's your thoughts on transition? Because I think everybody recognizes that it's not pardon the language, flip the switch and suddenly go from fossil fuels to electric everywhere. But what's a reasonable transition, knowing that people are starting to consider alternatives when they purchase, right? I think increasingly when people start to buy new cars, they're going to look to EVs. I think when people buy new homes, they're going to look at, are they, how climate friendly are they, size, et cetera. So I think it's going to be both for cost reasons and for environmental reasons. But what's a reasonable transition, do you think, Ron?
Yeah, well, I think we're going too slowly. I mean, if you look at the market share in Europe for EVs is significantly higher. We even lag behind large parts of the United States. So I think we could do this faster. And I think we need to focus on the opportunity side of sort of recognizing the big global opportunity that's out there for EVs. And I think governments are doing that. You see Doug Ford and Justin Trudeau make an announcement in Windsor, and this is apparently going to be the Windsor show. Yeah, just seeing those sort of opportunities, having those government investments in charging state and recognizing where the bottlenecks are. And for a lot of people, the bottleneck is range anxiety. So the more that the governments can, put in charging stations where people will use them. So that way you can run in, you can get your Tim Hortons, you can sit down for 15, 20 minutes. And by the time you get out, you've got a fully charged car, which again, you paid maybe $10 to charge instead of the $100 bucks that you're now paying at the gas station.
And anecdotally, a couple of years ago, I go to Perth a lot, Perth, Ontario, and a couple of years ago, they put charging stations on the main drag in Perth, just off Highway 7. And at the time I thought, no, it's a fairly rural area, the whole list, but they're busy all summer.
We drive down there quite a bit when we're headed back to London. So we almost always make a stop either at the Timmy's or the Starbucks right by that grocery store. So we know, and absolutely, you go past there and there's cars all the time at the charging station. I think that's fantastic.
Can we shift gears a little bit to talk about housing? Because I know you've written a lot about what the cost of housing has done. Essentially forced migration in the province, and maybe elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And it all stems back to some changes that the federal government had been making over the last 10 to 15 years that had caused population growth to start to rise in 2015, particularly in the GTA, with no change to municipal planning or provincial planning or how the rate at which we construct homes. So we had this big sort of population boom and a shortage of houses, which caused two things. So one, it caused the prices to go up. But as families, and it was largely driven by young families with kids, as they kept losing those bidding wars, they're like, well, this is not going to work. So instead of trying to get a house either in Toronto or Mississauga or Oakville, they do this phenomenon called drive until you qualify. So you basically see the size of mortgage you can qualify for, and then you get in the car and you drive down the 401 or 403 or wherever you're going till you find a community in which you can afford to buy a home that meets your needs. You know, it's a nice community, there's a school nearby, you know, whatever your family's needs are. Since about 2015, we've seen this large exodus of young families across southwestern Ontario. So, Thorold, just outside of St. Catharines, is one of the fastest growing places in Canada. Lucan Biddulph, where my family's from, similar thing, grew about 20% in 5 years. Tillsonburg, which, up here in Ottawa, all they know about Tillsonburg is a Stomp and Tom song.
My back still aches
when I hear that word. Exactly. And they think it's, I guess they're still picturing tobacco fields or whatever. No, like it's all been replaced by soccer fields. You go out to Tillsonburg and it's just amazing. It's just house after house after house, all of which have been built in the last 5 years. So we've had these housing shortages, which have really changed southwestern Ontario in ways that I don't think we fully comprehended yet. And we have all of these smaller communities who are, getting an influx of young people and are changing. So now you go to Woodstock and you have bubble tea places. It's mm-hmm. the days of, you've got the seed co-op and things like that. That's done, right? These ex-urban places are getting younger, more hip, more urban. And, I don't think, myself included, I don't think we've fully figured out what the economic and political consequences of that are going to be.
Well, you could see an upside where it's good for a place like St. Thomas. It's new, it's younger people, more incomes. And you can see a downside where it squeezes out some of the people who make St. Thomas or Southern Ontario incomes competing with, particularly post-COVID, Toronto salaries.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a mixed blessing. On the one hand, let's say St. Mary's, Ontario, I had grandparents that lived there for a while, and you know the average age was about twice mine. You know, it was getting older, wasn't really growing much in population. Now it's getting full of young families, and that's fantastic in a lot of ways. It's bringing a new revitalization to Main Street. You know, they're shopping locally. They're helping local businesses. The kids are going to local schools. The conversations have changed from, okay, how do we keep these rural schools open, to how can we start building more, or where are we going to get the portables to put on the school ground? So, you know, that's all really good problems to have. But you're absolutely right that we're also seeing displacement go on, that rents are shooting up. It is displacing low-income locals many times. So you're seeing, in many cases, homelessness rates go up in these communities and so on. So it creates that sort of policy challenge. And we really can't think of, again, issues like homelessness or issues like gentrification as being like a Toronto Hamilton issue anymore. These things are happening at the same level at, you know, your Woodstocks, your St. Mary's, your Owen Sounds, and so on.
Yeah, where arguably they have fewer resources built in because they haven't had to deal with it in the past, or to the same level as in the past, in order to deal with that part of the population.
Yeah, absolutely. So the municipal governments have never really had to think about these problems. They don't have those structures in place. And culturally, there's just a mind shift as well, where you spend 40 years trying to figure out how to retain young people and all of the issues around dealing with sort of population stagnation and decline, to all of a sudden going, oh, like, how do we get more daycares here?
Yeah.
You know, it's just that mind shift is, I think, really difficult for these communities.
It wasn't that long ago that many of these communities were branding themselves as a great place to retire. You know, slower pace of life, fewer people, lower costs, your money will go longer. And suddenly, now you're right, it's daycare, and where are we going to put the next school?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a mixed blessing. I love these communities. I love seeing them do well. But, you know, there is a public policy challenge in helping them deal with that growth.
Do you see affordability improving on the horizon for housing?
Well, I think it's going to be a mixed bag. So I would say, with interest rates going up, and they've already gone up, if you look at 5-year discount mortgage rates, we've gone from about 2% to 3.5% in less than a month. And we've got another rate hike coming in a few weeks from the Bank of Canada. That should probably send mortgage rates even further. So we're already seeing, in parts of Southern Ontario, average or medium prices go down, at least in some areas, in some neighborhoods. So London, for instance, went down about 50,000 in 1 month. We went from 800 to about 750. Obviously, there's all kinds of sample size issues there about, yeah, you know, which homes are going on the market. But yeah, we do start to see a slowdown. I think the challenge there, though, is you don't necessarily have better affordability, because any sort of savings in the lower sticker price are eaten up by higher interest costs. So really, yeah, the sellers don't win because they're getting lower prices. The buyers don't really win. Yeah, they can make a lower down payment, but oftentimes they're having to make monthly payments. So really, you know, I suppose the lenders win, but even the big banks are sort of borrowing against the Bank of Canada overnight rate. So yeah, it really reminds me of sort of a be careful what you wish for situation, where people go, okay, well, higher interest rates will create more affordability. I'm like, well, no, but they might still, but they're really just sort of transforming the housing market into one with higher monthly payments rather than higher down payments.
Do you see any parallels or any contrast between where we were 2008, 2009? I mean, obviously one, particularly Southern Ontario, will stick with our theme. Yeah. We were off of a good solid 10 years of growth, and the public, for the most part, said, as we walked into 2008, this is a blip, right? It's going to come back. I don't believe that things fundamentally are wrong. Public opinion today is obviously 2 years post-COVID, some angst. It's a lot more worrisome, right? It's a lot more, not sure we know where things are going. I don't think people are panicked, but I think that at least our data shows they're more polarized in their views. So the older, pensionable, higher income they saved a lot during the pandemic, and largely they're going, I'm okay. The middle class seems to be squeezed. It seems more of a middle class angst than it is a, but I wonder if you see any parallels from an economic standpoint and, or contrast in the two potential recessions.
Yeah, I would agree that you've got 30% of the population who did financially really well under COVID, that they still work from home, but they weren't commuting, they weren't driving anywhere, they weren't going on vacations because they couldn't. Oftentimes they weren't buying cars and large appliances because of the supply chain shock. Because it's like, even if I wanted something, we've got this microchip shortage and I can't get the new fridge I want. So oftentimes they pump that money into the real estate market, which actually kind of caused part of this price acceleration. So I would agree that you have this real division that's happened the last while, that you know, older white collar workers have done pretty well over the last couple of years and probably have a pretty positive outlook, whereas younger workers. But I would also, you know, and I don't know if this shows up in your data, but I would also think some seniors, like middle and lower income seniors, who are sort of on fixed income, now seeing prices rise 6-7%, you know, they've got to be a little bit worried as well. On the housing side, actually, where I see parallels is a little bit closer to 2017 in the GTA. So we had from about 15 to 17, as I mentioned, prices went up and up and up and up and up. Sort of a bit of a bubble. Well, not even a bubble, because actually, again, as I mentioned, it was kind of driven by fundamentals, but it attracted some investors as well. Then we had both the Wynn government and Trudeau government really do a number to crack down on speculative activity. We saw things like changing of the stress test to make it harder for people to get out, get themselves into trouble, changes to mortgage insurance rules to require larger down payments and so on. So you saw a correction in the GTA, right? And I think we're going to see another sort of correction here. But the issue with it back then, and I think the issue with it now, is we still haven't dealt with the underlying supply shortages. So you get this correction, and I think what happens is policymakers start to wipe their hands clean and go, okay, we're done. Problem solved, mission accomplished, put the banner on the battleship, and we can kind of go off and do our thing. My concern is that happens here again, that we get a price correction, prices go down 20-25%, and we go, oh, well, that housing thing is taken care of. But no, there's some really big underlying structural issues in this market that we need to deal with. And if we don't deal with it, we're just setting up the conditions for, you know, the next housing boom.
Is that in part because we've pinned our economic prosperity to a certain extent on immigration levels?
I don't want to sort of blame immigration, but I do think we aren't doing enough in other areas, right? So maybe we are asking our immigration system to do too much. Now, that said, I don't have any issues with the numbers. I think they're good. And I should point out that a lot of our population growth actually isn't driven by immigration in the technical sense. It's actually driven by international students. That some of those changes that we made over policy, and these go back to the Harper years, have caused a boom in the international student market. And what we've been doing is treating our colleges and or allowing our colleges and universities to be sort of part of the immigration system. And I'll explain by this. So if you go back to 2008, Diane Finley, when she was minister responsible for this, made a number of reforms to make it easier for international students to stay after graduation and eventually get permanent residency. And I think this was actually really smart. And the reason her thinking was, or what she stated was, look, we've always had a problem in this country recognizing foreign credentials, right? We bring people over in the 30, they're a doctor from some university that employers have never heard of. We can't get them, you know, we have trouble integrating them into the Canadian workforce. So instead of having them get their credentials overseas and then immigrating over, why don't we have them get their credentials here in Canada? Come over, instead of coming over at 28 or 29, come over at 18 or 19, you know, go to U of T or Seneca or wherever, get your degree, get your diploma, and then stay and get permanent residency. So we made those changes, and I think they made a lot of sense. And over time, particularly around 2014, 2015, we really liberalized the system to get to allow colleges and universities to really get their enrollment numbers up. And the big difference between the sort of immigration system and the college and university system is the immigration system, we have numerical targets, right? We're saying, okay, we're going to allow, you know, there'll be about 450,000 people in. With college and university enrollment, the number is whatever the colleges and universities decide it is, right? There's no cap the same way that there is for permanent residency. So what happened was that colleges and universities saw this amazing international market, saw that it was kind of, you know, there was a big opportunity here, and also had their budget squeezed by provincial governments over the last decade. So like, okay, you know, we smell opportunity.
Fish where the fish are.
Fish where the fish are. So it's been a good thing. And again, I think on net, it's been a good thing in the sense that, you know, we've got some of the brightest, most ambitious people in the world coming here in their teens and early 20s and going, okay, this is a place I want to stay. I think that's a fantastic thing. The problem is we never coordinated our housing policies with our international student policies and our immigration policies. So those numbers went up, but we didn't really change the rate at which we allowed housing to be built, again, particularly in Southern Ontario.
Are we doing that now?
Well, we're trying to. So the Ford government is trying to. And I'd say, first of all, we sort of recognize that there's an issue, right? And we've had Prime Minister Trudeau say explicitly, you know, tying the issue of population growth to housing completion. Like, you know, said outright that that's the issue, that our population is growing faster than our housing completion. So they sort of recognize that. The Ford government here in Ontario, they've recognized it as well. They had a supply task force that they put together back right around Christmas time. They did a number of sessions. You know, they talked to a lot of people in the space, myself included. They came out with a report that had 55 different recommendations and set this target for 1.5 million net new homes over the next decade, which is double the previous decade. The Ford government enacted some of the reforms, but left most of them still on the table. So, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done. But the one thing I will note is all four major Ontario parties have committed to this 1.5 million target. So they at least agree on the end goal. And it actually reminds me a lot of climate change.
Right? I was like, about to say, it's like climate change targets.
It's like climate change where it's like, okay, we all agree, except this time is you know, it's all the parties. There's no disagreement about the target there. The real question is, what do we have to do to get there? And I think the parties are getting us closer there. But, you know, I don't think today what we're seeing from any of the parties is going to allow us to hit this 1.5 target.
So progress, but not enough as of
exactly
today.
Which reminds me a lot of climate change.
Yeah. Well, we seem to be dealing with a series of issues like that, right? You know, the healthcare is getting better, but not enough. We're moving forward on climate change, but not enough. We're addressing housing, but not enough. We'll see what happens with interest rates and inflation. You know, well, actually, I'd love to hear your views on that. Are we doing enough, and are we going to get down into a 2% range? And I'd love to mention the Bank of Canada without talking about firing anybody. but what are your thoughts on avoiding a recession, a soft landing?
Yeah, and so that's the tightrope that the Bank of Canada has to walk here, because the Bank of Canada mandate is clear, right? That they need to keep inflation between 1-3%, and most of the time, inflation is caused by monetary factors. It's just caused by, you know, too much money chasing too few goods, and the problem is, you know, controlling the money supply side of it. The issue, and that's still an issue here, and I won't suggest otherwise, but we have this secondary issue of all these supply chain shortages, right? We've got all of the issues happening in China with the lockdown, you know, not being able to get enough goods coming over. We've got blockages at the ports. We don't, you know, we've had issues with truck drivers, as I mentioned earlier. We've had some drought issues. Now we've got all these issues in Ukraine with the war and issues on you know, Russian oil supplies, and so we've got all these international factors which the Bank of Canada has zero control over. Mm-hmm. So what the Bank of Canada has to try and do is get inflation down while at the same time hoping that those international issues resolve themselves. And what the Bank of Canada wants to avoid is the sort of worst of all world scenarios where they engineer a domestic recession by really hiking rates up, but at the same time, we still have inflation because of all this oil thing, you know, so basically like a 1970s style stagflation.
Yeah.
You know, that's the sort of worst case scenario here, and that's what they're trying to avoid, but it's tough. I mean, they have an explicit mandate on inflation, and their typical policy levers are not as useful as they typically are.
It's come at a bad time from public opinion as well, from a public opinion, from a potential reaction. I mean, we saw as early as late 2018, 2019, people saying prior to COVID, people saying in our data, there's lots of jobs, but they're not good jobs.
Yeah.
And I'm not keeping up the cost of living. I don't feel like I'm progressing like I was told I would if I got an education, I got a good job. And then COVID came along. And you know, as the ship turned was on fire, we stopped focusing on the horizon. We, you know, and then we've, you know, post COVID, this fire's not out, but it's calmed down, and we're looking around. We're going, oh, those things are still there, and maybe in a worse situation before. You're worried about any recessionary panic that people just like full on flip into. I'm going to hoard. I'm going to save because you know, it's been a tough 2 years, and I don't trust anybody's assessments right now.
Yeah, I think there's a real risk of that. And again, tying it back to the Bank of Canada side, that I think there is concern that as interest rates go up, people will worry about a housing crash and, you know, worry about economic decline. And the funny thing is that economics, particularly macroeconomics, is full of self-fulfilling prophecies. Right? In the sense that, like, if you and I and everybody else think that some stock is going to go down, we're going to sell that stock and we're actually going to cause it to go down. So our beliefs actually drive economic activity. So it very well may be that Canadians see interest rates go up, they see a softening of the housing market, they freak out and go, okay, well, I'm going to get out of the housing market, or I'm not going to go buy something. Why don't I just go buy a government bond? Now it's paying 3.5%, right? Yeah. So I'm going to throw my money into the bond market, and I'm going to stop going out to eat, or, you know, I'm not going to buy that new dishwasher once I can finally get one because the microchip shortage has corrected itself.
Nine months.
I keep using that example. I ordered one in December, and I still don't have it. So this is coming straight from personal experience. Yeah, I am worried about that.
And I know
the Bank of Canada is worried about that as well. That they want a soft landing, but that's hard to engineer, right? Because as people see things starting to slow down or starting to weaken, they think, okay, now's the time to get out. Now's the time to just put everything into cash, which, you know, from an individual perspective makes a lot of sense. But when we all act that way, it has these big collective effects.
Yeah, and I think from our end, when we look at our data and we look at where the public are on at, the fundamentals don't look good. I mean, if you look at financial health, it's down and it's stayed down. And it's very polarized. The shorter-term sentiment, a little more volatile. You know, it was down a lot in February, down a lot in March, bounced back up a little bit of late. You know, I think people are, and you can see it, Western Canada's bounced up because oil and gas prices are good for them. Gen Z's bounced up because I think they're looking at housing prices going, I see some relief on the horizon. So there's some short-term things. I just think it's too soon. People are still trying to figure out where the tea leaves are and make their decisions. But it looks worse longer term. We're about a two-thirds who say, you know, my anticipation is over the next 10 years, the best I can hope from a quality of life and from a financial perspective is status quo or worse, which is hard to imagine a sort of booming optimism at the current pace that we're on. You teach a course in political risk.
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How's that been evolved over COVID?
Things have certainly changed. I developed this course about 7 or 8 years ago. The short story is, Ivy, like any good university or school, we do a scan every so often of what are the other top schools doing and what should we be doing. And I was involved in this process. Actually, it's probably closer to a decade ago. I don't know. Time's been weird under COVID. And one of the things I noticed doing this scan was that a few U.S. schools had been doing a course in political risk, mostly for MBA students. So Ian Bremmer of the Eurasia Group has one at NYU, former Bush cabinet minister official Condoleezza Rice has one at Stanford. And at the time, nobody had one in Canada. So I said, hey, this is a neat opportunity. So, why don't we do something on this? So I convinced the university to do this sort of as a kind of semi-elective, and it really took off. We've got every year, we get more students wanting to take it than there are spots. And what we look at, or, you know, this is kind of a Canadianized version, but we do look at global risk. So we're looking at issues like, Canadian mining company goes to Romania, wants to open a gold mine. You know, what are the risks and opportunities there? You know, what should they be worried about? What should keep them up at night? How can they mitigate risk, but also recognize that risk is an opportunity. Being able to develop your risk management skills creates an opportunity because risk acts as a barrier to entry. Right. It kind of scares off potential competitors. So if you're better at identifying and managing those risks, it creates a real sort of market opportunity. So Ivy is a case-based school. So we do a number of global cases looking at, looking at companies, how they manage that. Some did it well, some did it less well.
So if I had to flip it on its head, if you were at another school outside of Canada looking into Canada, what would you see as the potential political risks?
Well, I think there's a few. I think one of the biggest risks we have for Canada is a lack of policy certainty. So a big one, going back to the Ontario issue, has always been our energy market and our carbon market, where had you had carbon permits under the Wynne government, you know, those quickly became worthless under regime change under Ford. And, you know, there's ongoing sort of lawsuits and things like that. So we've always had some issues there. Obviously, we have sort of more, we have economic risks as well, you know, fluctuating currency and things like that. But I would definitely say our climate and energy policies, both at the federal and provincial level, that lack of stability makes it a difficult environment for companies in the energy space and the mining space or so on, because they don't know what the rules are going to be 5 years from now.
Yeah, and that's where the bulk of the investment that comes into Canada is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Internationally, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. So that's an issue for us in a way that it might not be an issue for some other country. You know, other ones as well, sort of supply chains. I think what happened at the border, again, in Windsor, what happened at the border with Windsor of, our auto parts not being able to go across the border, I think that has worried international companies going, okay, if I put a plant in southwestern Ontario, am I going to be able to get my parts down to the assembler in Tennessee? That would be a big one. But overall, I've kind of said the risks for Canada. I mean, overall, I would say our political risk is relatively small. But yeah. But one of the things we teach is that the political risk is sort of situational, right? So the risk for a mining company in Canada is not going to be the same for, if somebody wants to come in and go into our grocery market, for instance. You know, it's one could be higher risk, relatively speaking, than the other.
Fair enough. I think I've bugged you enough about the economy now, so I want to shift gears to you had COVID.
I did. Yes.
And
not
I know
recommended.
I know from your tweets you've had a challenge getting your running times back. Do you think you could play championship dodgeball right now?
Yeah, no, I don't think I could do championship anything right now. So as you pointed out, I used to be used to play a lot of dodgeball, particularly in my 30s. Yeah, no, it's been tough. It was funny. My COVID symptoms weren't particularly bad. I never got really sick. I was just kind of low energy, but I never really fully recovered either. I noticed about 2 to 3 weeks afterwards, and like I would, most days I'd be running 5K or on the rowing machine or things like that. I have a son. I'm usually got him in the jogging stroller, and we're going all kinds of places. I'd get winded after walking a block or two. you know, and that was early 2021. Things are mostly better now, but yeah, I don't have any sort of ability to run anymore. You know, I could run, I used to be able to run 5K in about 23 to 24 minutes. I don't think I could do about 40 now. Like, it's that bad. The only upside is I hate running. So,
you've solved a problem.
Yeah, no, exactly. I'm like, if you had to take anything away from me, if I had to lose something from COVID, I'm like, that's not the worst one. It is a little bit scary, though.
You want to stay away from the Lone Star tick that makes you allergic to red meat.
That would be bad. Yeah,
that would be a bad one.
I would miss steak more than I miss running. That's for sure.
Finally, because I know it's both a personal issue and something you're writing about, the disability support programs. From what I've read, you've pretty much a pox on all their houses, on direction of where they're going. But any thoughts on that, where we're headed, and is there hope?
I think there is hope. So this comes from a personal place. I have my son, who just turned 7, he's on the autism spectrum, and he's on the more sort of severe side of the spectrum. Sort of intellectually, he's about 12 to 18 months or so. He's a fantastic kid, really sweet, makes me laugh constantly. We have the best time together. So we've been fighting the Ontario Autism Program battles over the last 4 years, but also you start to think, it's like, okay, he's 7 now, but at some point, you know, 11 years now, do the math, that eventually he will be an adult, and eventually, you know, he's going to have to make his own way in the world, because as much as I keep trying to, I'm not going to live to about 120. So eventually he's going to have to make his own way. So you start thinking about, okay, what does this future look like for him? You know, I've been writing a fair bit on the Ontario Disability Support Payment System, again, because it's sort of a top of mind issue. Since about 1995 or so, since the election of Mike Harris, you know, our system hasn't been great. You know, we cut back due to austerity back then, and we never really recovered. Since then, we've in the current election, we've seen the Green Party say that they will double the rates, which would actually push people with disabilities over the poverty line, barely, but they'd be on the happy side of it.
On the right side, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And now, you know, over the last few days, the NDP reversed course and said that within 2 years, they would make a similar change. So not quite as fast as the Greens, but they're committing to it. The Liberals and Conservatives are making more modest changes, but you know, so on the one hand, like I'm frustrated, right? I don't think this is enough. But at the same time, I kind of lie down and think, well, we have, you know, pushed, and again, most the disability advocates have done far more than I have. I've been more trying to just amplify their message. But they've managed to get the parties, at least the Greens and NDP, to commit to an extra $5 billion a year of spending. So that's not nothing. So, you know, as frustrated as I am.
Cracking Overton's window.
Yeah, exactly.
In the right direction, yeah.
Yeah, so as frustrated as I am with progress and seeing, you know, just the awful stories. We've had stories in the media about people with disabilities not being able to find a housing, who are now, you know, moving towards medically assisted death now that that's been liberalized in Canada. You know, just these horrible stories. So, you know, I'm simultaneously really frustrated by the pace of change, but also sort of intellectually going, well, no, you know, we've had some victories, so let's celebrate those.
Must be a challenge to set your personal frustrations aside from that intellectual side of things. Well, unless you have anything else, this has been great. Thank you very much. I'd love to get you back someday to talk about the price of perch. Because it tends to be, for me, every time I drive to Southern Ontario, I'm constantly amazed year after year after year how it seems to be in an ever-ending increasing product price. Has ties to the environment, climate change, supply chains, the economy. And obviously, you know, as we joked before we got on here, we should just talk about the number of mics from Southwestern Ontario, because there's a few of us.
Yeah, just a few. I remember being in elementary school, and there were, I think, 6 of us in one class. And I actually spent most of my childhood being Mikey, because you had to differentiate Mike from Michael from So I, you know, being, I was actually the smallest and youngest one in my class. So I got saddled with that.
So you got the Mikey likes it.
Mikey, yes.
Live cereal.
Yeah, I would hear that multiple times a day. I still occasionally do.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Mike. And we'll talk hopefully again someday.
I look forward to it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Educated Conjecture. Follow us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts for another episode of Public Opinion and Informed Insights. If you have a topic you'd like to see covered on an upcoming episode, please send us an email at publicaffairs@ipsos.com. That's publicaffairs@ipsos.com.